Well, good evening once again. Day 34 of the Biden administration. Tonight, to mark the sorry occasion of our nation's loss of over 500,000 souls to a controllable virus, the president and vice president did something we have not seen from an American leader in the full year since this pandemic took hold of our country. They took note of the devastating toll with a moment of silence and a candlelight ceremony to honor the dead. Moments earlier, as Joe Biden spoke of the need to remain vigilant against the virus, he acknowledged the enormous loss.
That's more Americans who have died in 1 year in this pandemic than in World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. That's more lives lost to this virus than any other nation on earth, as we all remember. I also ask us to act, to remain vigilant, to stay socially distant, to mask up, get vaccinated when it's your turn. We must end the politics and misinformation that's divided families, communities, and the country.
Exactly 1 year ago, no COVID deaths had been reported in this country, and there were about 35 known cases. As of tonight, the death toll stands at over 502,000 Americans. Confirmed cases now top 28 million. While vaccines do now exist, the CDC says fewer than 6% of Americans have received the shots. As this president works to get this pandemic finally under control, he's also trying to get his cabinet nominees confirmed. This morning, his attorney general nominee, federal judge Merrick Garland, testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee almost 5 years after he was supposed to testify before that committee, after his Supreme Court nomination was instead blocked by Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans. Today, Garland invoked the Oklahoma City bombing as he promised to go after the rioters who desecrated our Capitol January 6th.
I supervised the prosecution of the perpetrators of the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building. If confirmed, I will supervise the prosecution of white supremacists and others who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, a heinous attack that sought to disrupt a cornerstone of our democracy. This will be my first priority and my first briefing when I return to the department if I am confirmed. We are facing a more dangerous period than we faced in Oklahoma City at that time. I come from a family where my grandparents fled anti-Semitism and persecution. The country took us in. And protected us. And I feel an obligation to the country to pay back. And this is the highest, best use of my own set of skills to pay back.
Republicans tried to get Merrick Garland to make promises about Special Counsel John Durham's review of the FBI's 2016 investigation of the Trump campaign. Garland would only say he saw no reason to stop Durham's inquiry. And because Republicans apparently believe Hunter Biden would be a central issue for any attorney general, Merrick Garland was also asked about the current investigation into the president's son.
Have you discussed this Hunter Biden case with the president or anyone else?
I have not. I would not have taken this job if I thought that politics would have any influence over prosecutions and investigations. I'm not the president's lawyer. I am the United States lawyer.
Meanwhile, just across from Capitol Hill, the Supreme Court today cleared the way for Manhattan prosecutors to get their hands on Donald Trump's tax returns. The former president has fiercely fought to shield those documents from prosecutors and the public.
It's under audit. I'll release them when the audit's completed.
At the appropriate time, I will release them. But right now, I'm under routine audit. Nobody cares.
While I'm under audit, I would not give my taxes. There's no law whatsoever.
Actually, I paid tax. And you'll see that as soon as my tax returns. It's under audit. They've been under audit for a long time.
That last comment referenced reporting from the New York Times last year revealing that Trump had paid no taxes for a decade and then $750 in taxes the year he won the presidency and his first year in office. Today, Trump responded to the Supreme Court order in the ongoing investigation with a statement that read, as did his last one, like a series of tweets. It reads in part, quote, "This investigation is a continuation of the greatest political witch hunt in the history of our country." Meantime, Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance's full statement was simply, quote, "The work continues." The Supreme Court also dealt Trump allies a blow today when it declined to hear a dispute in Pennsylvania over whether absentee ballots received up to 3 days after Election Day should have been counted in the 2020 presidential election. Tomorrow, the investigation into the riot at our Capitol moves into a new stage with the first congressional hearing on the topic. Four high-ranking law enforcement officers, three of whom have by now resigned, will testify before two separate Senate committees. They include the former House Sergeant-at-Arms Paul Irving, former Senate Sergeant-at-Arms Michael Stenger, who both stepped down after the insurrection and have never spoken of it publicly. Some of the rank-and-file officers who came under attack that day are just now speaking out. Here's what one officer had to say about that day.
I got called a couple dozen times today, protecting this building. Is this America? They beat police officers with Blue Lives Matter flags.
With that, let's bring in our leadoff guests on this Monday night. Ashley Parker, Pulitzer Prize winning White House bureau chief for The Washington Post. Melissa Murray, she's an NYU law professor who clerked for Sonia Sotomayor while she was on the U.S. Court of Appeals. And Dr. Naheed Bedelia, infectious disease physician, medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit up at BU School of Medicine. During Ebola, notably, she worked with the WHO, which we note the U.S. has since rejoined under this new administration. And doctor, because of the urgency of the matter we mark today in terms of a death toll of 500,000, I'd like to begin with you. Do you ever allow yourself a kind of what-if thinking? What if we had been competent at this? What if our president had not been a denier? What if we had buckled down and done the hard work required, not let politics get in the way of mask wearing or not? How would our nation look different tonight?
Every day. But, you know, I think that to say that this pandemic is going to alter and has already altered the course of history for our country, but really our entire world, is not hyperbole, because we mark the 500 deaths that we've had here and we're rolling towards this other horrible tragedy, which is soon will mark 2.5 million people who died globally of this disease. And that's not even, you know, the entire number. It's thought that the deaths both here in the U.S. are underestimated directly from COVID. And that's not even counting the second wave, Brian. In every single epidemic that I've been part of, the people whose lives are affected, medical care is affected due to other diseases that could not be attended to because of the pandemic. And globally, things like drop in vaccination rates, not even taking into account the fact that this is the biggest economic shock since the Great Depression. And you've already seen 115 million people being pushed into extreme poverty globally. To me, it says, you know, what President Biden said today about remembering as part of healing, that's important. But we also will have to rebuild. And what we rebuild, you know, we'll have to not just pandemic-proof our society, but we're going to have to politics-proof from here on out our pandemic response.
Ashley Parker, coming right off the doctor's answer, quoting Joe Biden today, he also used special language designed to resonate with all of us who have suffered losses in our lives. I just kept writing down humanity, sympathy, and empathy. Last time we spoke, I asked you about this transition in tone and tenor, what it must be like to cover this new presidency. I don't think his most vehement critics would accuse him of insincerity on this front. And in a way, he is wearing the pressure of what he sees as job one.
That's absolutely right. And that's what made what we saw earlier tonight so moving. It wasn't just him addressing the incredibly stark, almost hard to fathom toll of human life, but it was sort of talking so personally and movingly about it. And we all know his past history with his own grief and in some ways where those wells of empathy come from. But those moments in the speech where he talked about the empty chair at the kitchen table, opening the closet and having a certain scent waft out, remembering the bend in your loved one's smile, that was all so personal. And it was even perhaps more resonant when you sort of couldn't help but contrast it with former President Trump, not just his handling of the virus that got us here, but keep in mind today, Donald Trump did put out a statement. It had nothing to do with the 500,000 Americans who died from this virus. It was, as you said, basically a tweet thread about the Supreme Court decision. So it's sort of those adjectives you laid down for Biden: empathy, sympathy, and then also just that contrast to the president who is no longer there, but in many ways got us to this place.
Professor, the court of last resort was not enough for the former president today, the most transactional president in our history, the man who came to the job with the least knowledge of the three branches of government of any president in our history, probably expected way back when his three appointees to go his way. They, of course, as no one needs remind you, did not. My question to you is, what will the public see? Or what will the public find out as a result of the Supreme Court ruling today? Or will its impact really be limited to a grand jury room in New York?
Well, as you know, Brian, grand jury proceedings are secret, and any of the evidence that are used in a grand jury investigation would remain secret unless there is a trial or some further investigation where those documents are made public. What the public may see in time is the path of this investigation gathering steam and taking on more contour. So we may see more information about witnesses. Some witnesses may make deals with the prosecution that will become public. And so this is just the beginning. And that's the thing. We've waited 5 years to get to the beginning. And this is what this long process, this long arduous process has been about.
Dr. Bedilia, I want to read you a quote from an article back in your bailiwick from three physicians from Mass General. They wrote this in The Hill. It's about the virus and the effect, the threat of the variants. Quote, "This is a very serious warning to the rest of the world. Immunity is not absolute and may have an expiration date. The bottom line, we are far from being out of the woods, even while there is reason for hope." This dovetails, Doctor, somewhat with what you just said about how it's changed our society and global society. Do you go as far as these three physicians?
I do. And I think no perfect example exists to show us how dependent we are on the rest of the world as they are on us, because part of getting to the end of the acute phase of this pandemic, because I think most of us in my field will say, I don't think this virus is going to be eliminated, at least not in the near future. But to get to a point where we can keep this variants from new variants from growing and addressing all of us, reaching all of us, is that we need to stop the transmission everywhere. And so we need to think about this as a global fight, so that new variants, once we update our vaccines, they will become quickly outdated unless we make sure the vaccines get everywhere in the world.
Ashley Parker, back to politics. I don't want to insult the bar scene in Star Wars with a useless comparison to CPAC coming up this weekend, but it's really going to be something. Can Donald Trump, with his first public appearance before that group, insist upon his leadership role in this party going forward? We already know that one Mitch McConnell and others may disagree.
They certainly may, but he can also absolutely insist that, and he probably will. And in some ways, CPAC was where it all started for Donald Trump. And it's been an open question. We don't really know the answer to what sort of power Donald Trump still wields in the Republican Party. We know some polls where his approval ratings are still quite high among Republicans, although they have dropped after the January 6th attacks. There's some disconcerting polls as well about the number of Republicans who believe his lie that the election was stolen. But until he comes out and speaks to a crowd, and again, this is a very specific crowd, this is very much sort of a MAGA Nation crowd, his base, and see not just how they react, but how lawmakers react who are up for re-election to Donald Trump and what he says, this very well could be the first test of does he have the power he hopes to have and claims he has, or by dint of the fact that he is an ex-president, and frankly, he is an ex-president who helped egg on an insurrection against the government he led at the time. Does that in any way diminish his clout?
And Professor, finally to you, while it's not a term from the law, by all accounts, Judge Garland crushed it today at his hearing simply by being a modest man of the law and talking about his family's history in this country, talking about how he would and would not approach cases. Tell me about it is believed he actually picked up Republican votes today, if indeed he goes on to be confirmed as AG. Tell me about what he's going to find at DOJ, what they will find as a kind of new culture, remembering that he will be the first attorney general in 4 years to not view himself as the president's lawyer, as he put it today, instead, the lawyer for the United States.
Well, this was a winning performance from Judge Garland. And again, this was the performance that I think many people would have expected to see in 2016 when he was President Obama's appointee to replace Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. He obviously did not get that hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee, but here we are 5 years later. And this was an amazing performance, evocative, moving, poignant, but then also really clear-eyed about the difficulties facing the Department of Justice. He spoke about the morale at the department. It is at the lowest it's been in a number of years. People are questioning the independence of the Department of Justice. All of that needs to be restored. And at the same time, there are external threats that have to be dealt with. And he faced those head on today, talking about his own history, fighting domestic terrorism within the United States in Oklahoma City and elsewhere, and the fact that these strains are proliferating in the United States today, and they need to be addressed by a Department of Justice that is reinvigorated and ready to take on that task.
Indeed, he called 1/6 the worst attack on our democracy he could imagine, and said that getting inside these groups, rooting it out and investigating that would be job one for him. Can't thank our big three guests tonight enough, Ashley Parker, Melissa Murray, Dr. Naheed Bedelia. Much obliged. Thank you very much. Coming up for us, as Texas puts itself back together, I'll talk to a member of Congress demanding answers about what he calls a total meltdown. And later, will the big lie lead to the great divide inside what is left of the Republican Party? We'll ask two campaign veterans what the former president's iron grip means for the GOP. After an emotional day at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, the 11th hour is just getting underway on this Monday night.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
had an $1,800 total for Monday and a $2,000 total for Tuesday. And I was just shocked.
Every day, they took a little bit out and a little bit more and a little bit more until when it was all said and done, it was almost $17,000. There was no disclosures. There was no warnings.
It's unbelievable. It's adding insult to injury for the thousands of Texans now being blindsided with exorbitant electricity bills following last week's deadly winter storm. The governor has ordered companies to temporarily halt cutting off power for non-payments. That's big of him. Several investigations are already underway into the state's energy crisis, including one led by House Oversight Committee member Ro Khanna, who promises, quote, "Once the dust settles here, I also plan to hold a hearing with the leaders responsible for this total meltdown." For more, we are happy to be joined by the aforementioned Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat of California. And Congressman, thank you very much for coming back on the broadcast. I guess I'd start this way. When members of Congress from Texas, you know who they are. They tend to be a vocal bunch. And politicians back home in Texas ask you, what's a liberal Democrat from the Bay Area in California doing, heading a hearing on our problem in our state? What's your answer?
Well, I'm a member of Congress for the United States, and the subcommittee I chair on the environment, the Oversight Committee, has jurisdiction over the United States. This is our responsibility. And one of the most outrageous aspects of this crisis is politicians getting up there and lying to the American people that somehow this was caused by renewable energy, when the facts are so obvious that the failure was actually of the natural gas pipelines. Yes, there was some failure of wind, but wind is such a small percentage. Texas has been largely dependent on natural gas. They failed to weatherize. They had this problem in 2011. There were reports saying they needed to weatherize. They didn't make those investments. They've been selling the country on deregulation, and now we see the consequence.
Sooner or later, we're going to realize that infrastructure should be an enormous challenge, an enormous goal for our country. Are we calling it by the wrong word? There's nothing unsexier than infrastructure. As I always say, FDR had a different word for it. He called it jobs.
Brian, that's absolutely right. And it's actually one of the few places where we should be able to get bipartisan agreement. I mean, when you have that kind of public investment in jobs, you're absolutely right. That's what FDR said. You're creating opportunity for people in communities. You're building the foundation for economic growth, and you're protecting people from natural disasters like we just saw. So if there's ever a clarion call for having that kind of politics, it's now. Adam Sewer had a great piece in The Atlantic, and he said, look, the politics of cultural grievance can win you elections, but when you have real crises, like a power outage, like a pandemic, politics of grievance does not work. You actually need competence. You actually need vision. And that's the moment we're in.
Congressman, while you've done nothing to deserve this fate, please join us in listening to Ted Cruz on Hannity tonight. Okay. We will discuss on the other side.
Texas has some of the lowest energy prices in the country. It's the cost of living is affordable. There's a reason people are fleeing the state of New York. There's a reason people are fleeing the state of California. The grid failed 4 million Texans. And so we need to have a serious examination about why that was, why the grid came short. But one of the major elements of that is actually the policy that Schumer is pushing for the whole country, which is the Green New Deal.
Congressman, there's so much there. I don't think he wants to commission a new marketing slogan, Texas, come for the low cost of living, stay for the cold and dark. I do think he might be alleging that Chuck Schumer somehow turned out the lights. What do you make of that?
You know what's sad, Brian? The governor of California, my home state, Gavin Newsom, he didn't take a shot at Texas. He said, let's do everything that we can do to help our fellow Americans. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she didn't take a shot at Texas. She said, let's do everything we can to help. Here we have people in California and New York saying, people in Texas are our fellow citizens. Let's put their needs first. I don't understand why Ted Cruz at this moment is politicizing it. It's almost like he doesn't believe we're the United States of America. If someone is hurting in Texas, it's as much a concern to me as an American as if they were hurting in any other state. And it's so divisive at this time.
Well, who is buying the argument that this is somehow connected to the Green New Deal? You correctly pointed out AOC has raised $5 million for people in a state other than hers.
It was just such a lie. I mean, the reality is that this was clear, the cause. They didn't invest in the weatherization. They didn't anticipate that there would be this kind of winter. It'd be understandable if it was the first time, but 10 years ago, they had reports telling them to make these investments. And it actually is easier, if anything, to weatherize wind and to weatherize renewable energy than it is to weatherize natural plants. So if anything, this should be an argument for having more renewable energy. And those are the facts that need to come out. But one of the things we need to explore is this disinformation campaign. I mean, it's disinformation, not just about elections, but disinformation about the climate, disinformation about renewable energy. And it's an epistemic crisis in our democracy that's being fueled by social media and certain cable news and really preventing good policy.
Congressman, thank you so much for coming on. Democrat of the Bay Area in the great state of California, Congressman Ro Khanna has been our guest tonight. Thank you. Appreciate you taking our questions. A private citizen in Florida, the only one to be twice impeached, wants to make it even clearer that the party that sold out to him is still firmly in his grip, or should be.
I would not support him for re-election in 2024. He's going to have a voice, but as former presidents do. But there's many voices in the party. And again, he should not define our future. We've got to define it for ourselves.
Asa Hutchison of Arkansas trying a new slant, and that is vowing not to support the president in 2024. Donald Trump will make his first public appearance as a former president when he speaks at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, on Sunday. Maggie Haberman of The Times writes it this way, quote, Trump has signaled to several allies and advisors in recent days that he is focused on running for president again in 2024. Mike Allen over at Axios reports that according to top Trump allies, quote, Trump plans to send the message next weekend that he is Republicans' presumptive 2024 nominee with a vice grip on the party's base. Lot to talk about. We have the two perfect guests to do it. Back with us tonight, David Plouffe, former Obama campaign manager, senior advisor to President Obama, also happens to be a member of the board of the Obama Foundation. And Tim Miller's back with us, contributor to The Bulwark, and the former communications director for Jeb Bush. Tim, just like the congressman, you've done nothing to deserve this, but here's where we're going to start. Join me in listening to Lindsey Graham tonight on Fox News.
He will position himself as the alternative to Joe Biden. He, I think, will make a speech that will unify Republicans on policy. That I think he's been working the phones. I was with him all weekend. He wants us to win in 2022. And stay tuned. I think you're going to see over the next couple of months, Donald Trump lead the Republican Party on policy and give us the energy we need to take back the House and the Senate.
So, Tim, it naturally follows he was such a policy guy for 4 years in the White House that he would just kind of morph into this role. Your reaction?
Yeah, wasn't Lindsey Graham done with President Trump on the night of January 6th? Yeah. That lasted about 12 minutes, right? I guess it was just one trip to the airport getting yelled at by people in red hats, and all of a sudden Lindsey was back on board. Here's the problem I was encouraged by what Governor Hutchison of Arkansas had to say. The issue with that is that Donald Trump's former press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, has, you know, declared the Arkansas State House hers and cleared the Republican field of the lieutenant governor and soon to be the attorney general of the state of Arkansas, because all that matters to Republican voters is fealty to Donald Trump. And so when you hear what Lindsey has to say, when you hear what Asa Hutchinson, when you hear what all these Republicans have to say, what is undergirding all of this is that everybody realizes Republican voters want Trump And that's why in open races over the next 2 years all across the country, you're not going to be hearing any Republican voters that are, Republican politicians that sound like me. You're not going to be hearing any that sound like how Mitch McConnell sounded the day after the impeachment with his finger wagging speech. They're not going to sound like Mitt Romney. They're all going to sound like some version of Sarah Huckabee Sanders, like some version of Lindsey Graham tonight over on Hannity, because that's what their voters want. And they're stuck and they're scared and they missed their opportunity to get rid of him.
So, David, for lack of a better term, the Burn It All Down caucus is going to be with us for a while. Axios further reports that payback is the president's chief obsession, his chief motivator. It just makes for a lousy bumper sticker, does it not?
Well, this is the problem, I think, for the Republican Party, Brian, is if you look historically in national elections, presidential elections, in core battleground states, whether they be Senate or governor, generally, the party that wins those races is the party whose base is more closely connected to the middle of the electorate. And the Democratic Party from 1968 to 1992, as you know, only won the White House once in 76, and that's probably only because Ford parted Nixon. So the Republican Party right now, and by the way, they're putting all their chips on Donald Trump, who failed to get over 47% of the vote twice. But Tim is exactly right. The people who vote in primaries, who give most of the money, who are most active on social media, they would pledge lifetime loyalty to Donald Trump and his family. And so if you look at the 22 Senate map, you've got key Senate races in Wisconsin, Arizona, North Carolina, Pennsylvania. These are places where I think Trump continuing to be the face of the Republican Party will hurt his party in those competitive Senate races, much less looking down the road to 24. Now, I think Trump's motivation here is obviously he's probably the greatest narcissist ever to be on planet Earth. But, you know, I'm sure he thinks to the extent he looks like he could run for office and be the nominee, that may help him in his legal issues. I doubt that's the case. And that's the one thing. Is Donald Trump going to look as attractive to the Republican primary voters 2 years from now, 3 years from now, than he does now? Maybe he will, but I would definitely take the short on that.
And Tim, I sucked at math, but I know he came in second at the in this last election. I'm asking this because of the new polling that shows that three out of four, like 76% of those who voted for him would support it again. And again, caveat withstanding on math, that doesn't look like a winning number.
Well, Brian, that tracks with about 70% of people that voted for him that think that he legitimately won and is the president in exile down in Mar-a-Lago, and that, you know, Hugo Chavez stole the election from him. So no wonder they would want him to run again in 2024. I mean, this is the problem when you're that disconnected from reality. You mentioned his CPAC speech. They set this up for him where his first speech after the presidency will come right after the announcement of the winner of the CPAC 2024 straw poll, that very important straw poll. Trump will get to declare victory, you know, after losing the election. He's so desperate, as David said, to be a winner and to be a narcissist that he wants to declare victory in something when he comes back to speak. And so in Orlando, he'll be declaring victory in the CPAC straw poll. And you know, that I think is a reflection of sort of where the movement is right now.
Wow, way to ruin the suspense. Our guests have both agreed to stay with us while we fit in a break coming up for us. Elections have consequences. The Biden White House sees firsthand the difficulty now of managing a slim majority in the Senate. We'll talk about that after the break.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
Well, everyone heard that one of our Democratic senators, Joe Manchin, doesn't want to vote. I vote for her. I am working with President Biden to find the extra votes so she can be passed. I think she'd be a very good OMB leader.
So Schumer's very narrow majority may cause problems for Neera Tanden. That's Biden's pick for budget director today. Republican Senators Susan Collins and Mitt Romney said they indeed would oppose her nomination after West Virginia Democrat, mind you, Joe Manchin, announced he would vote against her on Friday. Right now, Tanden needs at least one Republican to walk across the aisle and support her nomination. Back with us, David Plouffe and Tim Miller. David, so much to discuss here. Number one, Joe Manchin, as a Democrat, I went through his voting record, voted for Sessions, Barr, Pompeo, and Kavanaugh, and yet he is offended, apparently, by the tweets that this woman has put out over the past several years. Viewers of this network know her from her many appearances. Susan Collins, I'm just assuming, is troubled by the whole thing. Axios is saying this, which is what I want to ask you about. House Democratic leaders are quietly mounting a campaign for Shalonda Young, longtime congressional aide, to replace Neera Tanden as nominee for director of the Office of Management and Budget. People familiar with the matter tell Axios. David, you know, you've been around the block a couple of times. Your first rodeo, this is not. You don't get stories like that talking about alternative candidates when your candidate is in good shape.
Right. Well, that seems wildly premature to me. I still think they have some time to find that one Republican vote. And if not, you go to plan B. Yeah. So listen, first of all, yes, there's a challenge with having a narrow House majority and certainly a challenge with having 50 Democratic senators. But that is a far preferable problem than having 48. And if you look at, you know, within the first 60 days of his administration, Joe Biden's going to get a COVID relief package through, basically his design. Perhaps the minimum wage is going to have just about every nominee sail through. So this has reached a hiccup. I don't understand why. Neera Tanden is immensely qualified for this job. And I think generally presidents, when they put forward qualified candidates, should get support from both parties, but certainly unanimous support from your own party. So on substantive ground, this makes no sense. My guess is some of these Democratic senators who are in tougher states may want to, you know, cherry pick a vote here or two to suggest that, you know, they still retain their independence. At the end of the day, this is not, you know, Joe Biden used to say often when I worked in the White House with him, you know, no sense dying on a small cross. This one makes no sense to me. But I think the big parts of Joe Biden's agenda are going to get through, even with that narrow majority. And I think that's important to focus on. But I still think it's worth fighting for Neera Tanden because I think she's a special talent. And I think she'd do an amazing job at OMB, which is one of the tougher jobs in government.
Tim Miller arguing she's mean on Twitter after 4 years of the Trump administration. That was we drove out a laughable territory a week ago on that. But our mutual friend Bill Kristol said the same thing on our broadcast last week. He feels like he's onto a theory here. I feel like there's a little bit of sexism going on here. It just seems like these tweets sound harsher to these old guys because they're coming from a woman. Tim, what say you?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that the Republicans, sure, there might be some sexism there, but they're just looking for any scalp that they can get. And I think that the Republicans obviously are not arguing in complete bad faith. You know, like if Mitt Romney wants to decide that he is going to draw a hard line on people's behavior on Twitter and whether or not, you know, it's within the bounds of what he thinks is the appropriate decorum, I'm going to give Mitt Romney that leash because he's been doing that for 4 years. But the 49 of the rest of those yahoos have been allowing the commander in chief of the United States to send out things about how SEAL Team 6 is really dead and Osama bin Laden is alive and yay white power. And I'm very concerned about the white genocide that's happening in this country and QAnon and the election was stolen. We could go on and on all night, Brian. So the idea that they care about the director of the Office of Management and Budget's tweets is something I'm not going to buy. So hopefully Joe Biden can bring out the old Senate deal maker Joe Biden and get Richard Burr, one of these guys, across the line in exchange for, you know, putting the Office of Management and Budget Auxiliary Office down there in Wilmington, North Carolina, or something like that. And Neera, who's immensely qualified to have this job, gets appointed for a job that she richly deserves. And if not, I hope Biden puts her somewhere else in the administration and the Republicans are forced to just deal with someone else. I don't really see what anybody's gaining on this except for the Republicans trying to stick it in the left's eye, which is, I guess, the only thing that they exist to do these days.
Wow, Burr is a great idea. He could throw that new censure on the pile with his old one from the GOP back home in North Carolina. You gentlemen are both so good at this. It's why we keep having you on and having this conversation. David Plouffe, Tim Mellor, two friends of this broadcast, our thanks. Coming up, in a nation with a vaccine shortage right now, a look at the reason why thousands of doses are going in the trash at the end of every day. This is a report that we hope will bring about change. Tonight, in too many places, the vaccine remains in short supply, so many who qualify for the shot at this point can't find one. But health officials say leftover doses are going to waste because of an FDA regulation that prohibits pooling the small amounts of vaccine that are left behind in the vials. NBC News correspondent Katie Beck has more on the benefits and risks.
Shots go into arms 4,000 times a day at the iNova Vaccine Clinic in Fairfax, Virginia. For many, a dose of relief.
This is the happiest place on earth.
But while the clinic's pharmacy team hustles to keep up with demand, they're flagging a flaw in the process.
From the very first day, we've noticed that there was waste left in the individual vials.
Residual vaccine left in vials and forced to be thrown out. A single vial of Pfizer vaccine used here yields 6 full doses, but pharmacists say there's often a half dose left, which under FDA rules cannot be used.
They're just going in the garbage.
Yes. They are.
The pharmacists here who prepare the shots decided to measure how much is being wasted. First, pooling residual liquid in 10 vials, then 100. They found the discarded vials yielded 8 to 10% more vaccine.
Ultimately, when there are enough vaccines, wasting some at the bottom won't matter. But right now, we are millions of doses short.
In this location alone, that would be 400 additional doses daily. Nationally, it could mean tens of thousands more shots in arms every day.
Oh, it's huge. It's for such a scarce resource, it's significant. And currently, we're just throwing those out at the end of the day.
Those vials end up here in the basement. Most of them have visible amounts of vaccine still left inside. And pharmacists estimate that if combined, this rack alone could come up with somewhere between 10 and 15,000 doses. Instead of being given out, they have to be thrown out. The FDA says its rule against pooling COVID vaccine is an infection control measure needed for vaccines made without a preservative, saying cross-contamination using the same needle and syringe has occurred with other medications when this practice was utilized, causing serious bacterial infections. But pharmacists say there are already sterile protocols in place, and they are routinely allowed to pool other drugs like antibiotics, chemotherapy drugs, even the flu shot. They're urging the FDA to change its position.
It's heartbreaking. It makes me sick to my stomach, you know, knowing how many people still need the vaccine.
Many still waiting their turn without time or vaccine to spare. Katie Beck, NBC News, Fairfax, Virginia.
Something tells me they'll find a solution. Coming up for us, we are not used to hearing what we heard today from the man standing behind this seal. Last thing before we go tonight, the dead are those for whom the bells toll. The National Cathedral in Washington striking the bells 500 times for a death toll now over 500,000. They played Amazing Grace at the White House tonight, flanked by a sea of memorial candles on that south portico. Flags on our federal buildings will remain at half staff for the next 5 days to mark our nation's deep and ongoing wound. From our first school textbooks, we're taught that we are lucky enough to live in a great nation, and we are. We are further taught there's a phrase for it, and that's American exceptionalism. But what an unexceptional day this was in our nation's history. We've now lost over 500,000 souls. We in the news media have struggled to illustrate a number so high it seems ephemeral, like when we say we've lost the equivalent of the population of Atlanta or Miami. Or when the New York Times this weekend used a graphic where every lost life was represented by a black dot. Those lights lining the reflecting pool that we saw on Inauguration Eve, they represented 400,000 dead. We've lost 100,000 of our brothers and sisters since then. It has killed more Americans, as you heard, than our world wars and Vietnam combined. We in the U.S. represent about 5% of the world's population, yet we lead the world in coronavirus. Our death toll is the highest in the world, and no one should make any mistake about the malpractice, about the lies that were told to us by our president and those who worked for him. The benign neglect as Americans died. Denialism was pushed by adults who knew better in a country capable of far better. Here's what we know about the dead. Most of them died alone. All of them had hopes and dreams and people who loved them. In the Jewish tradition, it's customary to say of the deceased, may their memory be a blessing. And that has never been more meaningful, really. Their memories and legacies are all we have. How striking it was today to hear such personal notes in such hushed tones from our president. Humanity, sympathy, empathy in the face of a loss that makes us all feel helpless. How many of them would be alive had the virus that killed them not been first denied? May their memories be a blessing. That is our broadcast for this Monday night as we start a new week with our thanks for being with us throughout. On behalf of all my colleagues at the networks of NBC News, good night.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.